XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking to Howard University President Dr. Wayne Frederick about all things Howard University and beyond. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's talk to Omar. Hey, Omar, calling from Silver Spring. How are you?
Hello, sir. How you doing, Mr. Harold? Hello, doctor.
Doing just fine. Go right ahead.
I just wanted to, my question is, I'm a graduate of Howard University, and when I accepted a job, I was away in another state, and I wanted to continue my studies, you know, to get my master. My question is Howard University planning to open any mini campuses throughout the country or kind of do more like online business schooling? Is that something that the school is looking at?
Yes, absolutely. We're looking at more online as opposed to opening campuses. We're looking at more online opportunities. And one of those opportunities in particular that already exists, that if you are interested in business, we have an executive MBA program, which is an online program, an 18-month program that's very strong and has received a lot of very popular with our undergrad alums in particular. So it's one of those programs. We have RN to BSN program. That's an online program as well. We have, for pharmacists who are out practicing but would like to obtain a PharmD, we have a program online in conjunction with Shenandoah University. And we also have a cybersecurity certificate program. So we are bringing on more and more programs online.
Omar, thank you so much for that question. I remember around this time last year, you were introducing the online program, and there have been articles in online newspapers and the like about the growth of online college and university classes. Usually those things are done for grad school. What about undergrad school? Is that something that you would be interested in, or do you think that the on-campus holistic experience is still critical to undergrad education?
Yeah, you know, it's something that I'm certainly interested in, but I think you're absolutely right. We have to find the right balance. And you have to remember, we have students that come from 44 states and 71 countries. And one of the advantages of being on our campus is the fact that you could come here and meet the world. The fact that you're in Washington, D.C. gives you a portal to cultural experience unlike any other. This is one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world. You have embassies from all over the world. You have cultures from all over the world here, restaurants with different types of themes. So you really have an opportunity when you come to school in a Washington, D.C. to experience that. But it's a matter of finding that hybrid. Part of the popularity and part of the necessity of online education is to make what we do more efficient, to be quite frank. And we have to find, a way to make sure that we're doing that effectively, but at the same time, we can reap the benefits of being on the campus. And I think getting more hybrid opportunities that fulfill that is the way that we will go.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Mel, calling from Prince George's County. Mel, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Go right ahead.
Good. I'm interested in the safety. The president mentioned that 47 states, 71 countries. What is the level of homeland security that is for an inner city HBCU? I went to Fisk, and it was right across the street from Meharry. I'm wondering about the update for our young people who are moving ahead, seeking higher learning. Are they protected from the terrors of some of the people that are in the cities who may not be as warm and cordial to a mix of young students from other places?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things that we do is we have a very strong community effort. We have a community office that's run by a long-standing community member and we've really been trying to engage the community around us so that we understand them and they understand us. And as well, we are trying to collaborate and work with them as much as possible on a variety of activities. And we think that that's the first thing in making sure that that relationship is a vibrant one and a productive one. We also are attempting to open up our campus more as well to the community around us. So there are a couple of programs that we have on tap that would allow that, allow access to the library, allow access to the swimming facilities, et cetera, especially in the summertime when we don't have as many students on the campus as well. So I think it's a two-way relationship. We also have a healthcare system that delivers care. And so we certainly are embedded in the community through that portal of the hospital as well. And that's another area that we leverage a lot through having health fears and so on in the community. And that has been very effective for us in the past.
Well, Mel, thank you so much. I want to go back to the HBCU initiative. Last month, I spoke to the Secretary of Education, John B. King, Jr., and I asked him what the administration's plan was, the Obama administration's plan was, in offering more financial support to HBCUs even during these last few months. And he mentioned some things, but did you get any indication from this initiative and the work that you're doing that there will be more help for not only the students, but the HBCU community at large financially?
You know, that's a good question. And, you know, given the fact that we're getting ready to change administrations and so on, those are not things that I bank on. What I am intrigued by is the opportunity for us to help each other and to collaborate. So we have a variety of professional and graduate schools, for just as an example. And when I look at the population of HBCU students who are enrolled in my medical school, there just are too few of them. So this summer and last summer, we had a pre-health sciences program where we brought HBCU students to Howard's campus on Howard's dime in the first year. I paid for faculty to provide didactic instructions and MCAT and DAT prep because, again, I think we should be a destination site. And to make that point even more, or the need more glaring, is the fact that in 1976, more African-American males applied to medical school than they did in this last cycle. And that's a dramatic drop-off as far as I'm concerned. So our institution, because of our law school, our dental school, our med school, and our graduate programs, social work, divinity, the MBA programs, etc., we have to give an opportunity for students to be able to come from HBCUs to us. I think those are the types of things, the types of collaborations that we have to really push on that will help in terms of strengthening those institutions, et cetera. If more students from the other HBCUs go to professional schools, it raises the bar in terms of what they are. We will also start new programs that will also attract those students. So we're starting back our master's in public health, and we're going to bring on a PhD program in educational leadership. Again, to give the opportunities, and hopefully a lot of HBCU students will be the ones who will take those opportunities to see Howard as a destination site. And I think all boats will rise as we continue to do those types of things. So, yes, I'm hopeful that funding will rise, but I really believe that if we start helping each other, if we start collaborating around programs, and as a result, strengthening each other, I think that is one of the things that would really lead us to greater successes.
On the Masters of Public Health piece, when do you think that could happen?
Well, we're hopeful that we'll be able to start the first class as early as fall of 2017.
Mm-hmm. Because that's huge. I mean, public health is a huge career field, and it opens so many doors.
Yeah, and when you look at the disparities in healthcare, again, that'll be a major part of the focus of our Masters in Public Health program. So when you look at the incidence of diabetes, the incidence of end-stage renal disease, et cetera, in the African-American community, it's very high. And I think, again, we can serve the nation and serve the diaspora by putting out healthcare professionals that can bring the opportunities to change those statistics around in our community. So I think it's important. We talk about HBCU leadership all the time, but we need a PhD program in educational leadership in order to be able to really groom the presidents of the future. And so, again, I'm pleased to see us bring in such a program online.
Speaking of grooming presidents of the future, I wanted to ask you, can you give some clarity to the Donald Trump issue? There were concerns or questions about whether or not he was going to come to speak on campus. What happened with that?
So there clearly is interest, I think, in general, if you look at the Republican Party now in terms of outreach. It is clear that the demographics of the country is mandating that there be some outreach. So it is not surprising to learn that there has been some outreach to me and to my campus in general about having him speak. You know, the details of which I'd rather not mention some of those details, but you know, I don't think it's anything unusual. But with any of these types of stories, especially given the nature of the campaign now, those things take on legs of their own, as you can imagine. But we've never come to any agreement to have him speak on our campus.
I do have a little more time. Speaking of speakers, talk to me about Linda Johnson Rice. She is coming next month, as a matter of fact, the day after Election Day, to speak on campus.
Yeah, so Linda Johnson Rice has provided us with a gift to launch the Johnson H. Johnson Endowed Chair of Entrepreneurship speaker series, which is obviously named in honor of her late father, who was a pioneer, you know, businessman and in journalism. And she feels very strongly about entrepreneurship, which is why this has that focus. And she actually will be the first speaker on Wednesday, November 9th. So we're very, very happy to welcome her to campus. And we're very pleased about her gift to the university. We think, again, these types of things need to be celebrated. You know, we talk a lot about African-American philanthropy or the lack of it. And I think we saw with the opening of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, $545 million raised, or 570 something now, I believe, surpassed their goal. And quite a few African Americans donated to that project in a significant amount. And here at Howard, we're beginning to experience significant infusion of gifts from the African American community as well. I think that needs to be celebrated.
You've been to the museum?
I went to the opening. I haven't been. I'm actually going to be there on Sunday for a guided tour with my family. I didn't want to go without my kids. So,
oh yeah, well, there's that, right? Did you get in trouble?
Yeah, elected not to go until then.
With the opening, before I go to the break, talk to me about your impressions, even though you haven't had a chance to take on the full tour.
Well, first to begin with, I would say, you know, as a Howard president, anytime you see Howard on a national stage, it certainly brings you pride and warmth. But as a Howard alum, I still feel like it's that extra special. And to sit there and watch the Howard marching band perform, followed by the Howard singers, it just really was overwhelming to see us so well represented. I've seen pictures from the exhibit in the museum, and again, to see how many Howard pioneers are in there highlighted, it's a very humbling experience. And so I'm looking forward to taking that tour, you know, with my kids on Sunday, and I'm sure that I'd be filled with pride as I see the images of a Montague Cobb and so on in there.
And I would be remiss as we go to a break to let you know, I'm sure you know, that our own Mo Ivory from the TMG show has a quote in the museum talking about HBCUs. So certainly a member of our Howard family, also, you know, making a mark as she talks about HBCUs. I'm going to take a break. Lines are still open. We're talking to Dr. Wayne Frederick, Howard University president. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue the conversation with Howard University President Dr. Wayne Frederick, all things Howard University and other issues, obviously. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I wanted to go back to one issue about the hospital. You talked about the hospital being in the black, but we didn't mention that the hospital has a new chief executive officer, Mr. Deagle. Can you talk to me about that? Please?
Yeah, sure. Mr. Deagle is part of the team at Paladin Healthcare. He's a seasoned veteran in the healthcare executive space. And joined us on October 1st to continue to implement the strategic plan that has been laid out to obviously bring fiscal stability to the hospital, but also to bring operational efficiencies and excellence to the hospital. One of the things that our management service agreement with Paladin has outlined in it very clearly is the need for continuous improvement in outcomes and what we refer to as the core measures, the key things that need to be done in order to provide quality health care. And so I'm very pleased that Paladin is continuing to make the right types of changes to make sure that we're getting the right types of results. And Mr. Deagle is another step in that continuum.
What do you think is the most improved, obviously, finances, that's the big headline, but the most improved situation for Howard University Hospital as this turnaround moves forward?
Well, I think there's several things. I think our ability to deploy the right staff to the census is better. I think our ER times are shorter. Our ability to get patients to the floor is better. In general, if you look at all our customer service measures, those are better. Doctors communicating with patients, nurses communicating with patients, those measures that we get back in the surveys are better as well. So I think overall, you know, all around, when you look at where we are, all of those things are improving. Our outcomes are also getting better. So I feel very, very good about, you know, the job that's being done there. Yes, it's reaping fiscal rewards, but that certainly is not coming at a price of compromising any quality. It's coming along with improving quality.
I want to also talk about something else that's happening with Howard alum. Debbie Allen has a play about gun violence coming to the Kennedy Center. She was here this weekend for homecoming. Can you talk to me a bit about the play and the importance of having such a one of many high-profile alums coming back to the university?
Yeah, it was good to host her. She had a panel discussion on Sunday about freeze frame. I think it was well-received. I was able to catch the tail end of that. She's been very excited about this particular production. She's been talking to me about it for months. And I think, again, it talks to why people come to Howard. Because he is an absolutely talented individual. Can dance, can act, any type of performance, she's up for it. But also, what you get at Howard is the fact that our DNA is social justice, and her ability to become concerned and to want to intervene on a social justice issue such as gun violence speaks for itself, and that's why, you know, she did this. So I'm excited to see it myself. I'm looking forward to being there this weekend to see it. But I think based on the panel discussion, it's going to be very, very thought-provoking.
Again, 2 weeks before the presidential election, we've been here at Howard University Radio talking a lot about the impact of the millennial vote, as well as, I dare say, the Generation Y, the young vote. What is your message to young voters as we move very, very close to an historic election?
Yeah, well, you know, the first thing is I hope that all of us, and certainly especially our young people, but I hope all of us would think about the opportunity to participate in a process that can help decide the future. I think that's extremely important that we get to participate by placing our vote in terms of who leads the country. And that's one that we need to take and execute with some pride. And especially so now, more than ever, coming off of two terms of the first African-American president, I think within our community, we need to recognize that the America, with all its flaws and with all that we sometimes are cynical about, elected a black president. And that's history now. That did not happen without us getting up and going out and voting. So I think we must do that. But I also think there's a broader issue at hand, and that is how do we exercise our activism? And that we must recognize that our exercising of our activism cannot be unilateral. It has to be pluripotent. So we have to be looking at multiple avenues to exercise our activism. So yes, should we... Am I supportive of people who sit during the anthem? I am. I personally stand, but I am supportive of those who sit during the anthem. But my message to the young people is that even when the anthem is finished, you have to stand back up. And when you stand back up and you walk away, what do you go and do about it? Do you just wait for the next time you hear the anthem to sit again? Or in between the anthems you hear, are you out making a difference in your community? And one of the ways to make that difference, if you're really interested in changing things, is to get out and vote. So you've got to stand up and walk into a polling station and exercise that right that so many people died for in order to ensure that you have the opportunity to exercise.
It's interesting you should say that, as you may have heard before beginning this interview, I had an excerpt from a discussion with award-winning actress Alfre Woodard. And she is a Hillary Clinton surrogate. However, the majority of the conversation that I had with her almost is identical to what you just said when you're talking about millennials and just young voters. She was talking about protesting in the street. She was talking about Black Lives Matter. She was talking about kneeling during the anthem and all of those things. But she said, pretty much like you said, none of that does any good unless you couple it with voting.
Right.
Because it doesn't, she said, it doesn't make sense if you're just paying attention as a protester, but not also paying attention as a voter.
Yeah, well, I didn't hear, so I'm not plagiarizing.
Right, exactly.
I certainly share her sentiment. And the other thing, too, is that we all don't have to do the same thing, right? We all don't have to necessarily have the same activism. And that's why, again, you have a Howard University, because we want engineers to help participate in building bridges or building irrigation systems or making lives better in certain communities, right? We want to produce engineers who can go to Haiti and rebuild a country after a devastating flood. We want to produce physicians who are interested in closing the gap in disparities. We want to produce lawyers who can look at the continuous attempt to erode the rights of the Voting Rights Act and restore those. Right, we want to produce educators from the School of Education who are going to go out into our communities and make K-12 education better. I mean, that's part of the reason you come to a campus. So, yes, I absolutely agree. It has to be coupled with folks who are constantly trying to move the bar in terms of what we must do to have a more complete society. And so it does take that coupling. And it's often difficult as a young person because you want to see change, and you want to see it, you know, fairly dramatically at times. And sometimes that's what has to happen. Sometimes you need a very dramatic moment. But I think the testament of time will always speak to the drumbeat that must continue to occur to maintain a certain cadence and rhythm of social change over time. You must have that background drumbeat of people exercising the legislative process to change policy, people exercising economic empowerment to lift a community, those things must happen. You will have these dramatic episodes, but that constant drumbeat of social activism and change by doing all the things that we have to do on a day-to-day basis must be occurring.
Dr. Frederick, I only have about a minute left, and I'll ask you the same thing that I asked Alfre Woodward, even though we still have 2 weeks left in this election. What do you think the legacy might be of the 2016 campaign, particularly as it relates to African Americans?
You know, I'm a major optimist. Mm-hmm. My glass is probably 9/10 full all the time. And I hope that the legacy will be that even in the face of the worst of us, the worst of our political process, the ultimate outcome of it is still the best of us. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes we have to have the polarization and the mess to expose the rawness of the emotions of where we are so that the solutions that are then presented represent the best of us. If you don't know how fractured the country is, you can't put it back together appropriately, or you can't come up with solutions that are appropriate. So rather than be cynical or pessimistic about the divide that everyone keeps talking, I am hopeful that the next president, whoever he or she is, will be able to look at that political process, look at the worst of what it exposed, and really come up with tough solutions in order to continue to create as comprehensive a society as possible.
Dr. Wayne Frederick, our president of Howard University, as always, always a pleasure. Always learn something when you're here. So I appreciate you coming by and sharing with us. Good luck on the planning for the sesquicentennial. I know there's lots of work ahead. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Tuesday, October 25th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can reach me at hfisher@whur.com, on Twitter at hfisherwhur, or Daily Drum WHUR. Now, stay tuned.